Mr. Pat Sansom, Rail 3.
The train was full of Japanese soldiers who were rushing out of the, jumping out of the train because the it came to a stop, of course, the steam coming out of the engine. And we just flew round and round, just firing. You know, we had, I think we had a rear turret and a front turret on that occasion. We're flying round and round, firing away at them, and you could see them, you could see them dropping. And I felt a bit, I thought, you know, not a very nice thing to do, really. And I think that's about the only time in the war when I felt at all introspective in that sort of way. But, you know, it was great fun. The on another occasion, we were going for the main station in Bangkok, and we were doing our 50-foot bombing run, and I overshot, and it when we were coming back, we were listening to the I don't know what the Burma equivalent of Tokyo Rose was. We were listening to her on the radio, as we often did. Coming home, and she said that the English have just carried out another terror raid on Bangkok, and they've set light to the something or another pagoda, which is the second biggest pagoda in Southeast Asia. And so I thought that was probably me overshooting with the bomb. But it was a very exciting time, and we were very proud of ourselves, really. And I did a tour and a half with 159, and then I was sent back to Calcutta, and I got a job on the on a communications flight. It was the only flying job that I that was up for offer at the time, and I didn't want to do anything but fly, so I went to this communications flight, and that was very interesting. There were about six or seven different types of aircraft. And I had two interesting trips there. One was I flew a Major Peter Fleming, who was Ian Fleming's brother, you know, the James Bond man. He was Ian Fleming's brother. And I flew him to Akiab. That was quite interesting. And another occasion, there were some photographs had to go to Akiab. And the only aircraft that we had at the time was the Air Marshal's private Hurricane. And he said, I must use that. I said, I've never flown a Hurricane. I've never anything like that. And he said, well, you'll have to learn quickly. And he took me out and told me what sort of settings and boost settings for takeoff and, you know, various things like that. And off I went. And I flew 2 hours to Akiab and landed, fortunately, and gave over the photographs and 2 hours back. And that was quite a highlight of my flying career in a Hurricane.
Did you feel any anxiety at all?
No. Not that I can remember. I don't think I did. I think I was so confident, you know. That, well, I suppose I was 21 then. Yes, I was 21. Celebrated my 21st birthday in Calcutta. I went back on operations with a special duties squadron, which was flying from a place called Jessore in what is now Bangladesh, I think, and that was very interesting. It was dropping supplies to Force 136 people. Force 136 is quite a famous unit of sort of guerrilla fighters, and dropping supplies to them in what I think was Indochina, quite long flights, and also dropping agents too, which was, I thought they were the bravest people I'd ever known.
When you say dropping them, they parachuted.
They were, some of them were girls, I believe. I wouldn't know. I mean, they were just brought to the aircraft and sat in the aircraft, and we took off and dropped them.
But would they have been part of SOE?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, yeah. Force 126. Yeah, yeah. And you know, I couldn't believe what they were doing, but there you are.
Did you get to talk to any of them?
No. I think some of the crew talked to them during the flight, but I didn't talk to any of them. I didn't get a chance. I think they were told not to talk to us, actually, you know. They were Indo-Chinese, they were French people, they were, so I'm told. But
how many crew in the Liberators? How many crew?
Well, when we were at 159, we had a pilot, co-pilot, stroke flight engineer, that's two, a navigator, a wireless operator, and a rear gunner. That's all we had, or we had another gunner. There were five or maybe six. This other squadron, a number which I can't remember, we had about the same number, about six.
How much did you, to what extent did you look after your own aircraft and take an interest in it?
I took an interest in it. I didn't do anything to it. I mean, we had very competent ground staff to do that, but I went down and would go down every, you know, if we were flying, as we often did, we'd take off about 5 o'clock at night and come back about three or four o'clock in the morning. Mm. And after a bit of sleep, I'd go down to the aircraft and have a look at it, have a chat with the ground crew and so on. But that was really more a morale boosting thing as anything else, you know. But if something went wrong, I wouldn't know how to put it right, put it that way.
So what did the ground crew consist of? It would have been the armourer and...
Oh, there were... Oh, there must have been seven or eight. There'd be a sergeant in charge of the ground crew for each aircraft, I think. There'd be a fitter, couple of mechanics, an armourer, probably five or six, I should think.
Did you do much night flying?
It was mostly night flying, yes, except for the mining was done at night, and most of the bombing was done at night, but the target of opportunity stuff was all daylight stuff, obviously, just go out looking for something to drop a bomb on.
How accurate could you be with the mining and things like that?
Well, I think we were pretty accurate because it was all fairly low level stuff, you see. I mean, I think we were probably 70% accurate, which is a lot better than if you were dropping them from 10,000 feet, you know. I remember there was one that we were told how to go out and bomb a bridge not far from Mandalay, and there were three squadrons went out, two squadrons, I think 215 was one of them, bombed from about 10,000 feet, and when they'd finished, we went in at 50 feet, and of course we reckoned we destroyed it, but I don't know whether we did, but we reckoned we did. But it was, you know, that's, you can't be accurate from altitude, particularly in those days when the bomb sites were fairly primitive and so on.
It's very fortunate I picked up a copy of Guy Gibson's own book, Enemy Coast Ahead, and he talks in there how the low bomber pilots and the high bomber pilots, you know, used to get together and have little arguments about who had the toughest job. Yeah. How, what would you say about that then? What did you find the most difficult?
Well, I think it was much more dangerous to fly at 10,000 feet than come in low at a good speed. And I would have thought it was much more dangerous to stay up there and flying straight and level and dropping bombs than coming in low. I would have thought it was much safer to do that. But of course, we had very little opposition. You know, there was the Japanese were just about finished in 1945, you know.
How much were you keyed in to what was happening around the world, you know, the different theatres of war? What did you know about?
Well, we knew what was going on. We knew what was happening in Europe. We knew that we were making good advances in Europe. I remember we had a bit of anxiety when the Battle of the Bulge was on. I remember that got out to us out there, and we knew what was happening in the Far East, and so it was quite good. We had quite a lot to do with Americans. When we were going off it with this big bomb load and big fuel load with a 68,000 pound aircraft, we went to an American airfield to take off because it had a much longer runway. They had B-29 Super Fortresses there, so they had a much longer runway, and we used that. And the Americans used to laugh at us, you know, and they're pulling our legs, these little aircraft, and little things, what do you do with them? And we couldn't tell them. We had to keep quiet about what we were doing, but we had quite a bit to do with the Americans. I remember one bottle of whiskey was worth a case of 12 Budweisers. That was the barter rate at the time, until VJ Day. I remember VJ Day. I spent in hospital because I got malaria, but that was fairly simple.
How were you treated? How were you treated with malaria?
No, I didn't have. Yeah, no, I had malaria, I was. I don't know what they gave me. Mepocrine, something like that. But that turned. But I got pneumonia with it. I remember one night I was very hot, and I got out of bed and I stood at the window of the hut, and I got very cold and I got pneumonia, and I was treated with penicillin. Which was very early in the life of penicillin, and that cleared it up in no time at all. So I was very lucky there that I'd got it after.
Probably quite a pioneering thing, you know.
Well, it might have been. I don't know. I think it was fairly soon after the discovery of penicillin, but I was in hospital in Calcutta. I remember I woke up in the ward one morning, and this was after I'd had the pneumonia, and I was under for, you know, some while. I woke up and I looked around the ward, and all these yellow faces, and I was in a ward with a lot of people suffering from jaundice, and I thought it was a bit like being in a prisoner of war camp surrounded by Japanese, but that didn't last very long.
Were you very debilitated by the malaria, with the malaria?
I can't remember. They sent me off to Darjeeling, to a convalescent home up in the hills, for a fortnight. That was quite an enthralling experience. It was nice to look out and look at Kanchenjunga there and Everest over there and so on. It was a lovely spot. That was just resting and having a good time, playing hockey and table tennis and tennis. And then when I came back, I went to this DDT flight.
And I think I'm pretty sure that we pretty well wiped out DDT in the whole of the Rangoon Pegu area of southern Burma. We reckon it was it did a good job.
Do you mean that you wiped out malaria?
I think we did. The anyway, the number of cases of malaria dropped tremendously. I mean, it was quite remarkable. But of course, we didn't know the bad effects of DDT in those days. But it was very unhealthy for mosquitoes. We didn't think it was unhealthy for people.
How was it loaded up? It was done in Liberators, was it? Was it carried out in Liberators?
Yes, it was just Liberators. They had things like petrol bowsers full of it, and they pumped it into this tank thing underneath the aircraft, and we'd take off and just spray, you know, just run up and down. Well, no, running one way because the wind was blowing about one way, and it would, and it just settled on the water and on the the paddies and everything, and it was seemed to be very effective.
You were pilot then, were
yes,
you?
Yes.
Then what? It was a matter of pressing a button.
Pressing the button. Mm. There were four aircraft in the flight, and that was disbanded. And I wanted another flying job, and that was where I was posted a 160 squadron, and that was in Ceylon. And that was like life at a holiday camp. It was at a place called KKS, which was short for Kanker Sanctuary. It's right up in the northern part of Ceylon on the Jaffna Lagoon, where they're having all the trouble now with the Tamils. And it was just the airfield and the lagoon and the beach. it was marvellous. We had boats, we had sailing, swimming, everything. And that was about a couple of months. And then we were posted home, and I led the first flight of three aircraft home to the UK, which was quite nice.
How many in 160 squadron? How many men in the squadron?
Well, I think there'd be about 12 aircraft. I suppose that's about say 80 air crew. Mm. All this supporting people. They're probably about 200 or 300.
And that was typical of each squadron, wasn't it?
I would think so. Well, we at 159, we had 16 aircraft, and so we probably had a few more people, probably about 350 or something squadron. I meant to say that when I was at the Special Duties Squadron, I was there just after the end of the war, and that's when I flew down to Changi, down to Singapore, and was flying prisoners of war out, flying from Changi to Calcutta, and I did about three trips from that. That was awful. The poor chaps were in a terrible state.
Did you get to talk to any of them?
Yes, I did. Yeah, and they were overjoyed. Of course, they were going home, but they'd been through such awful misery and brutality. I remember one wing commander who'd been a prisoner for about 18 months, and he was about 6'3", 6'4", and he weighed 5 stone, and he obviously wasn't going to live. He just lay on his stretcher, and he sort of gave a sort of smile to us when we went past, but he I'm sure he died. That was an awful experience.
How long did you do that for?
Oh, I only did about three trips at about, a fortnight or so.
How many would you have taken on each trip?
Well, we bought about 20 back. We didn't have many stretcher cases, but they sat at the back of the aircraft and, you know, wherever they could, really.
What were you flying then?
As a liberator. Yeah.
Must have been so fragile, mustn't they?
It's just unbelievable. I mean, it'd be like, well, I don't know. Then how to describe it, really. I mean, I know that I hated the Japanese then, which in view of what happened after the war is quite funny, but I hated the Japanese for doing that, and, you know. I mean, I know that one of my air crew said, I wish we still had the turrets on the and some ammunition. He said, I'd wipe out a few of them. That was the nearest I came to any you know, real misery or conflict in the war, really.
Did you find that your mind dwelt on that a bit?
You did, yeah. Yeah, did a bit after the war, yeah.
And you've since met people, too, who have been prisoners of war.
Yes, yeah.
Do they talk about their experiences?
They don't really. I mean, I think it's so long ago now. I mean, I don't think the subject doesn't come up. I mean, you don't say to somebody, you know, what do you do in the war, Daddy? It's But when it does come up, it's very, very sad. I mean, what they went through, of course, most of them are gone now. I mean, what they suffered would ensure that their lives were shorter anyway, I think. I know these two people at the golf club, they were quite elderly, but I think a lot of people died much earlier than they should have done because of what they suffered on the railway in particular.
So from there, you led the squadron back to UK?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Would you like to talk about that?
Well, anyway, it was a very straightforward trip, really. We flew from Ceylon to Karachi, I think. Karachi to Shaiba. Shaiba to Haifa in Israel, or Palestine as it was then, from Haifa to Cairo to Castel Benito, which is in Tripoli, I think, and then from Tripoli back to St. Morgan in Cornwall. And I remember doing the worst landing I've ever done. The runway was up and down like this, and I misjudged it, and I put it down where the ground dropped away, and we crashed. Oh, terrible thump. But that was nice to be home.
It seems that you didn't really have many moments like that. That things were pretty straightforward for you.
I had an engine go coming back from Singapore once, and I think that was the only time I had a... I had an engine failure when I was at the communications squadron flying from Aleppo, and the engine failed. We came down in the jungle, but we were all right. We didn't hit anything.
How many crew?
There's one other chap in the plane with me, but we were all right.
Would he have been an observer?
No, it was an army chap who was. I was flying to Akyab, which is an island off the coast of northern Burma, and the engine failed. It was a bit frightening when it happened, but it was all right. I saw a clearing in the jungle and we went down in there.
Lucky that there was a clearing.
Mm. Yeah. But That was the only thing. I don't think I was lucky. I can't think of any other times. No, that was all. Lucky lad I am.
During your time out there, did you have any leave?
Oh, I had bits of leave. I don't remember much about it, to be honest, but I always felt that when I was on leave, I wanted to get back doing what I wanted to do, which was just fly, you know. And there was this time in Darjeeling when I was convalescent. I remember a few weekends in Calcutta, which were just going to the cinema, having dinner at, I think it was Furpo's, and just generally mucking about, just enjoying yourself. But I can't remember leaves in South Africa either. I'm sure I had quite a lot of leave when I was there.
What about meeting the locals?
Well, I didn't meet in South Africa. I met a few locals, but in India I had nothing to do with the locals at all, and they didn't have anything to do with us, really. We lived in a very much a close community, if you like. Our friends were RAF people, and that was that. We stuck together.
Was the Indian field ambulance around? Indian field ambulance, were they around at all?
I don't think so. No, I think we had our own ambulance. I think we had our own ambulance crews on the airfields. I had nothing to do with Royal Indian Air Force pilots or anything. No, sounds terrible, doesn't it? But we just kept to ourselves, really.
What was the drill if your plane was hit? What was the drill if your plane was hit?
Flying the aircraft when I was hit? No drill. You just, I suppose you're supposed to do what you could. We practiced a lot of, in the airspeed options, we practiced a lot of single engine flying. And when I was being passed out as a skipper on the Liberators, we shut down an engine or two and we were flying, but that was all we did. There was nothing else you could do, really. I mean, you could... The things were too big to deliberately stall. You know, when you're flying a tiger moth, you can... You practice getting out of a spin. You know, you bring the nose up and the aircraft slows down and stalls. That means it loses flying speed. And then you kick the rudder over, one of the rudders, and you go over and you spin. And you practice getting out of that by putting on opposite rudder and then pulling the stick back. But you couldn't do that in a big aircraft, you see. I mean, so you didn't really, other than just... when you lost an engine, you could practice that. But that was all.
Would you say you really love flying the Liberators?
Yeah, I did. I love flying anything, really. But Liberator was I thought it was a wonderful aircraft. I've heard Americans say on the television since that the Liberator was a devil to fly, but we never complained. We thought it was a super aircraft, and when we could load it up as we did, you know, it was obviously it had a big reserve of power, and so it was. I think the next nicest aircraft I flew was a can't remember now. The thing where the engine failed. What was that? Can't remember the name. That was a Fairchild. A Fairchild something. That was a lovely little aircraft, a single-engined aircraft. But